I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. This hour, we're going to be talking with Ben Jealous, NAACP President and CEO, and Gerald Torres, who is professor at the University of Texas School of Law and co-author, along with Lonnie Guinier, who's been a guest on his show before, of the book The Miner's Canary, Listing Race, Resisting Power, Transforming Democracy. They're part of a series of discussions that is taking place with OSI, the Open Society Institute Baltimore, entitled Do We Still Need to Talk About Race? And they'll be here in person in Baltimore tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. At the Enoch Pratt Free Library at the Wheeler Auditorium. You can join them there, but you can join them here right now and join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com or log on to our Facebook page and talk to us there. And let me welcome both Ben Jealous and Gerald Torres. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you
so much for doing this tonight.
Absolutely.
So I this is probably a perfect time for the two of you to be talking about this topic with the people of Baltimore, Maryland tomorrow at OSI, but first here, given everything that's going on in America right now, with the reaction against Barack Obama, the reaction against his policies that may have great deal more to do with race than just his policies, and we all keep talking about this post-racial society we're supposed to be part of now. So talk a bit about where you think this eruption that we're seeing in America from these meetings we've had this summer, the alleged town meetings over the summer, and what they really say about where our society is in terms of racial and being post-racial. Let me start with Ben Jealous and go to Gerald Torres.
Sure. I mean, yeah, we can't be post-racial until we're post-racism. That's just what it comes down to. We are having a national conversation about race, but that national conversation, it happens, fits and starts in eruptions. You know, it happens with Glenn Beck losing his mind for 45 minutes about Van Jones. You know, it occurs in a place like Rockford, in the great state of Illinois, where I was this weekend, where a young black man, unarmed, had been shot. He had in a church in front of daycare students, daycare kids. The cops had come to his house because of a domestic disturbance. He had gone to the church prior to them getting there to seek counseling from the pastor's wife. When the cops came out of the car, one of the cops that stepped out of the car was the only officer in that town to have shot multiple people in recent years and have killed at least one of them before. And apparently, fearing for his life, he ran into the church. And they pursued him into the church with guns drawn. And when he exited slowly from a closet in which he was hiding, they shot him in the neck. He spun around. They shot him multiple times in the back. All this in full view of the pastor's wife, her daughter, and multiple young children. And the people of Rockford, you know, who I was with this weekend, you know, I was making the case. And look, you have a choice right now. You can either, because we're talking to audience, you know, black, white, union members, religious people, local folks from the community of all sort. We can either, as a country, go towards Beck's vision of division that he's pushing out there with Rush Limbaugh and the rest, or we can try to take a step back and reclaim the hope of unity that January 20th brought us.
Gerald Torres, I'll take your take as well before we...
Well, I think before I address it directly, I also want to say that besides being a professor here at Texas, I'm also a board chairman of the Advancement Project in Washington, D.C., which is a progressive anti-racist organization, and working hard and working with people like Ben Jealous and NAACP and trying hard to get us to that post-racial society. But I don't think we're there yet, although... when you look at what's happening in our culture generally, I think there's a couple of things that are true. I think that to a large extent, you know, the people want to move past. I think the kind of minor interpersonal racial animus, but moving past that also allows people to forget or to ignore kind of the deep structural effects of racism. And that's the kind of thing that we need to keep our eye on. When you the thing that Ben was just talking about is really important. When you look at deep structural inequality, you look at the needs for healthcare reform, for criminal justice reform, for all of those kinds of things that we that the president is working on. And you look at the way that race cuts across that. One of the things that Lonnie and I have talked about is race really does serve as the miner's canary, and the things that affect black people in society first and affects them more harshly. It doesn't just affect black people. They are the people who will be affected perhaps first and perhaps more harshly first, but it really does affect all the institutions and everyone in our culture. And understanding that and not being able to reduce it to that old-fashioned script that people like Glenn Beck and others try to reduce it to is critical. And so we're not, I don't think, you know, we're at the point of reaching a post-racial society, even as we are moving towards, a lot of us trying to move towards the stage of getting past what I call kind of interpersonal racism. We need to get to that so that we can address the kind of deeper structural racism.
Go ahead, sorry. Ben.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think a perfect example of what Professor Torres is talking about as far as black people, you know, brown people, people of color being the canary in the great American coal mine is the foreclosure crisis. You know, we were out there, the NAACP was out there well over 3 years ago calling for a moratorium on housing foreclosures. And we largely got blown off by members of Congress saying, well, that's essentially that's a black problem, and y'all people are doing something wrong. And now that it's, you know, it's basically, you know, came close to bringing down the entire global financial system, you know, we get a different tune on Congress, you know, in Congress, a different tune on the banks. You know, we just wish, you can only hope that next time they take you more seriously, that next time they realize that we are all connected, that the issues that we're talking about aren't, you know, they may hurt us first, they may hurt us more in a way that's more pronounced, but they ultimately hurt everybody.
But there's something going on here right now, and I like that before we, I really want to explore in more detail the advancement project and more explore these ideas and the idea of what political race means. That you, Professor Torres and Lana Cooney are right about in the work that Ben Jealous you're doing. But something is going on in America right now that is. In all this talk of post-racial society is showing the eruption of the power of race and racism in America. And by that, I mean, you talked about Glenn Beck a moment ago, Ben Jealous, and that he has, in the last several weeks, along with others, gone after Van Jones and helped get rid of Van Jones.
Yep.
We've now seen Fox News, and you just talked about the mortgage crisis. Yep. And despite all of its shortcomings and all the things that have been going on with Acorn, which we've been covering here and talking to them about, that the they've been very effective in dealing with mortgage issues in inner city neighborhoods, whether they be black, white, or Latino, in America. And now the liberal progressive senators of America have joined in with the conservatives to be cowed by the right wing media to cut off funding from Acorn and their housing work. But so something is going on where there's been an eruption that has gotten so severe that it's made people who are seen to be on the progressive front fearful of standing up. And it's kind of fueled, to me, it seems, by a real racism and fear of a changing America. So I'd like the two of you to kind of talk about your analysis of what you think is going on right now.
Well, the you know, I'll jump out there. The,
Ben?
Yeah. You know, the you know, race, I think, is absolutely the subtext, right? I mean, certainly, you know, we are in the early part we are a decade into a century in which, before we get to the halfway point of the century, this will be a majority people of color country, right? And so there is a certain type of insecurity from that. There is a, there's also a pressing insecurity in this country because you have a lot of people who are poor now who weren't 6 months ago, who weren't a year ago. But what's sort of blowing my mind is that in all of this, Beck and his followers have been so successful at reviving red baiting. You know, like where did that come from? And are they serious? You know, but that seems to be what seems to have stuck in Congress was, this sort of like recessive McCarthyite gene and the ability to actually get folks, worried that, oh my God, they're calling Acorn socialist, they're calling them communists. He's using the old watermelon analogy that was, popular with right wing dictators in Central America. I mean, it's a great success, and that, I think that there's a much broader range of people that should be concerned than, black or brown people about the success of sort of neo-McCarthyite rhetoric.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. There's a kind of this, I guess, red baiting and race baiting that goes on. I mean, you go back to the debacle we had this last week, with Congressman Wilson, right?
Right.
Jumping up and acting in a way that was utterly disrespectful in the joint session of Congress. And of course, what he's complaining about Mexican Americans and Mexican immigrants, and that's what he's really complaining about, right? And let's be frank, right? When they talk about illegal aliens, they're not talking about anybody except people coming across the border from the south.
Right.
And that's.
Yeah,
that's
they're about. Certainly not worried about Canadians, which are actually a fairly large group.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the great Canadian raid.
Right. Exactly. They're worried about that, and that's just a different form of race baiting, and it's the kind of thing that on some level doesn't respond to truth.
But it's even worse than that because you have these sort of modern day Pharisees, these guys who walk around quoting the Bible and proudly representing the Bible Belt, and they're so estranged from basic Christian theology. It really sort of blows your mind. I just raise the Bible and Christian theology because they do, and the story of the Good Samaritan, is sort of a damning tale about people who behave in the way that they would like to see us behave. And what that story is about is, there is a stranger, there is a, a somebody who has migrated to your area, who's not, who doesn't have papers, and they're suffering at the side of the road. And do you help them or not? And if you don't help them, you're going to hell. So it's really. And what worries me is that you don't see more of a pushback from religious institutions in this country, from the religious right, saying, hold on, wait a second, we have basic core values, and that's, if you start sort of taking, the misuse of Christianity, you take the, this neo-McCarthyite rhetoric, you mix in kind of old-school racial fears, And we're really at a moment now where all of us have to make an active choice about what road we want this country to go down.
We're joined this hour by Benjamin Jellis, who, of course, is the CEO and president of the NAACP in our country, Gerald Torres, professor at the University of Texas School of Law, director of the Advancement Project in Washington, D.C., co-author with Lonnie Guinier of the book The Miner's Canary, Enlisting Race, Resisting Power, Transforming Democracy. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com, and we'll read your thoughts in the air, or just join us by phone. We'd love to hear from you during the course of this hour. What it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but what it seems to me is that when Barack Obama became president of the United States of America, that it created a divide that you began to see with the election of Bill Clinton, that you began to see with the attacks on John Kerry, which you began to see with the attacks on Al Gore, but with Barack Obama as president, the divide in this country has become glaring. And we hear the president talking about compromise and kind of trying to reach across the aisle, but it seems my gut tells me like I'm back in Mississippi in 1964, that the Gulf is there, and that there's something really profound going on with America redefining itself in a way that we haven't seen in maybe 40 years.
But the Gulf is a different Gulf. You know, you have on the one side, and of course, I was in Mississippi in 64, but I was there in 94 and 93 and was getting death threats because Byron De La Beckwith had just been put in prison. And
right.
I was leading 15,000 students to keep the in a march to keep the governor from turning a public historical black university into a prison. So it was still a fairly stark moment in Mississippi. And even in the last 20 years, you know, last 15 years, the Gulf has changed. You know, the people who harbor sort of the most hardened racial views, a lot of them have died off. You know, on the other side, you know, the number of people who are truly sort of tolerant, you know, has gotten bigger. And in between, you have a bigger group. People have sort of, you know, ambiguous or uncommitted feelings. And the danger in this moment is doing things that harden them. And I know we at the NAACP are spending an increasing amount of energy trying to figure out essentially how we win friends and influence people. How do we take those people who are in the middle, who could go one way or the other, and bring them over to our, you know, to our side? And we don't have all the answers at this moment, but man, we are committed to getting them, because we realize that the future of this country is dependent upon taking people who could go one way or the other, and bringing them to the side of tolerance and unity.
And Joe, go ahead.
No, I was going to say I completely agree with that. One of the things that Lonnie and I worked on and talked about, right? And you know, I work with Earth Day Network and NRDC, and you know, one of the things that we're deeply committed to is reaching out to communities of color. Through an environmental movement, which is you know commonly been conceived of as a white movement, but in fact, in many ways, you know, our fates are deeply linked, and the communities are deeply linked, and it's this idea of linked fate that we want to build on, because I agree with Ben that many of these hardened attitudes and the ones that you see the conservative commentators trying to fan and trying to stoke really do harken back to a period in our history that was not our best moment, and I think the one thing that Barack Obama really did do and has done is to give us a glimpse of what our best moments can be. And I think that in terms of imagining a future, a racial future that is promising, we need to look at the challenge of the people who are trying to fan the throwback moments and say, you know, we're not going to go there. That there are people of good faith who communities of color and white communities that really do have the same interests at heart, because those interests are the ones that helped mobilize to elect the president. And it was a broad election, and it was a deep election.
Right.
And we need to continue to build on those communities and say, we're not going to lose that that consensus that helped elect him on the basis of fear mongering and the people who are trying to reinvigorate an old script about race that is losing its potency.
Gotcha. Yeah, you know, Dr. King gave us probably the greatest challenge that we really have not ever tried to completely rise to. That Dr. King gave us was in his letter from a Birmingham jail, in which he laid out that white prison guards, you know, poor white prison guards and poor black prisoners have more in common than they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this notion that working class poor white people, working class and poor black people, the middle class, really middle class white people, really middle class black people, could be great allies, and Latinos and Asians and Native Americans could be allies. We really haven't, tested it, and I think that, quite frankly, there's been, reticence on both sides. But we're at a moment now where the financial system has become so turned on its head as far as its priorities. So we have, viruses out there like payday lending and title loans, right, where we have people who are being charged 400% or 1,200%, that there really is an urgent need for people to come together around financial interests and assert those. I mean, our economy, the priorities of it are really 180 degrees in many ways. That's why it's been in crisis from what most of us expect. And at the same time, again, the real hardened, dedicated racists, probably at their all-time low, numerically. But what that means is that we have to be willing to, shift from defense to offense. It means that we have to be willing to put, to extend a hand and to take a risk. And it means that we also, I think, have to be prepared, and this is, again, where we're investing a lot of energy right now and really trying to figure out what the answer is, but we have to be willing to talk about problems in a different way. I mean, I'll give you an example. Police brutality in this country is often talked about in racial terms.
Right.
If you're, from West Baltimore, my mom is, my cousins are, my uncles are, where I spent all my summers. If you see somebody get beat up by the cops, chances are they're black, right? So what you know is that black people get beaten up by the cops. The reality is that, disproportionately black and brown people do get beaten up by the cops, but also disproportionately poor people get beaten up by the cops. And actually, every single demographic group that, that we and our allies have polled complains about abusive law enforcement practices. Wealthy white people complain about abusive law enforcement practices. And so there's actually a much bigger set of allies for engaging on that issue and making progress on that issue than we ever talk about. But when we talk about it in primarily in racial terms, we end up shooing all of them, or many of them away, because they feel like, you aren't concerned about what happened to me. You aren't concerned about what I'm worried about. You're accusing them of, you're accusing them of being racist when really they just got a power issue to deal with. And, that's the type of sort of subtlety that we have to be aware of, because we're now in a moment where increasingly we have to, assert our civil rights and expand the social contract to include a broader range of human rights based on, 51% of the vote. And we can do it, but we can only do it if we are willing to really look and court allies and be willing to not just act differently, but to talk differently, which can be the hardest thing of all.
I wonder how, we should take a short break, because I want to explore, when we come back from this very brief break, how you two think we get there. One of the things of Barack Obama, I say this often on the air here, one of my favorite quotes from Barack Obama during the campaign, we talked about yesterday a bit on the show, was when he was asked, would Martin Luther King support him or Hillary Clinton? His response, and it's a paraphrase, was that Martin Luther King wouldn't support either one of us. He'd be out there organizing an independent social movement to fight for social justice and human rights.
Right, that's right.
And so I'm going to take a short break and come back and explore that. And I want to explore Gerald Torres's idea from your book, which is really intriguing, which I think is important to talk about, which is the idea of a political race and what that means.
Right. Okay.
So
great.
Join us here at 410-319-8888. Mike in Baltimore and others will come to your calls when we return from this brief break as we talk with Ben Jealous, President and CEO of the NAACP, and Gerald Torres, Professor at the University of Texas School of Law. They'll both be here tomorrow night in the OSI series, Do We Still Need to Talk About Race? It'll be at the Enoch Pratt Library. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas. This month, Urbanite goes back to school with a learning issue, featuring reports on the future of high-stakes testing, new approaches to the dropout crisis, and the challenges of teaching behind bars. Urbanite is available at over 750 locations around the region. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We are joined this hour by Gerald Torres, who is professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law, co-author along with Lonnie Guinier of the book The Miner's Canary, Enlisting Race, Resisting Power, Transforming Democracy. He's also, is it director, Gerald?
Yeah, I'm board chair.
Board chair of the Advancement Project in Washington, D.C. We're also joined by Benjamin Jealous. Of course, Ben Jealous is president and CEO of the NAACP, its 17th president. Is that right?
Yes.
Right. And they will both be appearing here in Baltimore tomorrow evening, 7:30 p.m. at the Enoch Pratt Free Library on Cathedral Street downtown at in the Wheeler Auditorium at 7:30 to continue the series Open Society Institute Baltimore has, a year-long series on race. Do we still need to talk about race? You can join them there live. Join them here now at 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Join us here on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page, and we'll read your comments online. But as we're going to break, I talked about the Martin Luther King quote, and I'm very curious how both of you think that we get to this place. I mean, what organizes a movement in this country that begins to fight for those changes? We've seen, in some ways, some people would argue almost a disillusionment of in the moment with the power of the right and what's happened over the summer, and some people are a little dissatisfied with the push being made in healthcare. So how do you think, where does this movement come from? How does that begin to happen beyond a conversation just about race?
Well, you know, first of all, progressives have to stop going on vacation, right? I mean, we saw it with, we saw it in August, where we got out Alinsky'd by the anti Alinsky's, and we saw it over Labor Day weekend where, literally I was out there trying to correct a spin on my good friend and long-time friend Van Jones, and I had somebody, I'll never forget this, till the day I die, on Friday of that week after Glenn Beck had been bashing him on, Wednesday and Thursday night, I was emailing back and forth with folks about getting some other leaders out there so I won't be the only one. and somebody said, Ben, don't worry about it. We got under control. The meeting of the Van Jones War Room has been set for Tuesday. And, of course, his job was gone by Saturday night.
Right.
Right. So, Tuesday was too late. And I say that, some other folks managed to jump out, but it was really, you could feel how isolated Van felt. You could feel just sort of the cold, the chill of this moment. And it was, either we respond right now or it's done. Right now, we and a number of groups are jumping out there on healthcare, and we've been successful, behind the scenes, keeping the public option in the mix, and to the extent it is, we will be the reason that meaningful healthcare reform is passed this year. So the movement isn't dead, but there is if we made a critical mistake in these first 6 months, we saw progress happening so quickly that we shifted in sort of technocratic mode and shifted out of real sort of, push mode. And the reality is that, we have to be in both. And we have to be out there on issues, quite frankly, the president isn't talking about yet. Like, for instance, the issue of payday lending. It should be a central part of financial services regulatory reform. We have legalized usury in this country, but through a series of loopholes. People aren't really talking about it the way that they should, but I'm sure that the president would make a part of financial services regulatory reform if we were visible and out there. And so the NAACP is preparing to do that. We've made a conscious decision that we're going to push on some things that we know are a priority of the administration because we want to make sure that they're done, big issues like health care, but that we're going to increasingly get out there on issues where we're confident that they would meet us halfway or they would even meet us at the finish line if we were pushing visibly first. And the president gets that in a way that's spooky and a little disconcerting because he's played the role before. We have somebody who's a community organizer, which means he's highly critical of the job that all of us are doing. And I've had private conversations with him, that have confirmed this. I've had conversations, follow-up conversations with senior staff that have confirmed this. Basically, because the president knows intimately the position that we're supposed to be playing, if he sees us playing it, if he feels like we're capable of it, he's prepared to meet us there, you know, on the battlefield. If he doesn't see us playing it, he's not going to expose his flank by stepping out in front of us, you know, in a charge that we're supposed to be leading.
Right.
Go ahead, Joe. Why don't you add to that, and we'll open the phone.
No. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, that one of the, you know, one of the our obligations, right, is to continue to stay organized, right, and to figure out, you know, where we can best contribute to organizing and organizing support. When Ben said, you know, we got out of Alinsky this summer, I mean, I think, you know, to a certain extent, he's exactly right. I mean, you know, the people were talking about, you know, a lot of the things that were happening this summer as AstroTurf. You know, to a certain extent, a lot of that was, I think, an accurate characterization. But to a certain extent, it wasn't an accurate characterization. To a certain extent, a lot of it was mobilization of anger and fear, right? And what the president did was to mobilize in the service of hope. And what we need to do is to continue to get the people who mobilized in the interest of hope and change, and continue to stay mobilized and to produce the change that we want to see happen. And I think that's what's really critical. And I think we need to not just rest, but to work. If we're going to be out organized, you know, we can't complain about it.
Yeah,
I mean, I hate to say it because it sounds like a scold, but I think to a certain extent it's true.
No, that's right. No. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, we have gone about a process of beginning to retrain the entire base of the NAACP, all of our, you know, leaders in 1,200 communities around the country, to be even more aggressive, even more adept organizers. We do a very good job, but we all know that we could do an even better job. The reality is that the Obama campaign won because they were a great campaign. If they had been a very good campaign, they would have gotten their clock cleaned the way that Kerry ran a very good campaign, Gore ran a very good campaign. You know, very good campaigns in these times lose. And
right.
and so we have to be self-reflective, and we have to be honest about you know, how much gas we have in the tank, and we and we've got to be eager and what type of truck we're driving, you know, and we've got to be eager to become, frankly, more aggressive and stronger. That's the message that I've given to our field, and that we're following, and quite frankly, we're following it with success. I mean, this summer we stepped out there, you know, for instance, in a small, sort of relatively small thing, you know, in the sort of the scheme of things. There was a man in Georgia named Troy Davis with a compelling case of innocence.
Yes.
And the court was not going to let it be heard. You know, our lawyers said that we had a 1% chance of prevailing in the Supreme Court. Well, we prevailed. You know, we prevailed after, you know, we put 12,000 signatures on the desk of the local DA and got lots of local media attention demanding that he reopen the case, you know, from citizens demanding that he reopen the case. And we got 65,000 signatures sent to him from around the country, primarily from black churches, because the DA in Savannah, Georgia, himself is a active black Christian. But we made the case aggressively in the court of public opinion. I was, you know, on Bill Maher and wherever else I could be.
Right.
you've got to do that. We live in a transformative moment where great things can happen. But if we sit by the sidelines and we don't, you know, make the Hail Mary play, even when that's the only play that's open to us, we give up sort of, you know, progress untold, and we do it on a daily basis. And that's, you know, that's the spirit that we need more of, because we really are at a moment where, when we have the best set of allies in every agency in the federal government that we've had in modern memory.
Right.
We're joined by Ben Jealous, you just heard, NAACP president and CEO. Gerald Torres is on the line with us as well. He wrote the book, Lana Guinier, the Miner's Canary, Enlisting Race, Resisting Power, Transforming Democracy. He's chair of the board of the Advancement Project in D.C. and professor at the University of Texas School of Law. What are your thoughts about race in America? Can we fight racism in America, build a cross-racial movement in this country to push for real change? 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Let's get your thoughts in the airwaves. Let's go right to the phones here and get our listeners in here and continue this conversation. By the way, you can hear live again tomorrow night in person at the library at 7:30 p.m. the Enoch Pratt as part of Open Society Institute Baltimore's conversation on Do We Still Need to Talk About Race? But right now, join us here, and we'll get to all these calls coming in. Going first to Mike in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Mike.
It's a pleasure talking to you guys because we got some serious business we got to talk about. This country is in a profound, deep economic crisis that's giving rise to this right-wing reaction you're discussing. Right-wing reaction historically uses race. That's what they do. Can we overcome it? Of course we can. The question is, what vision do we have to offer people of how we can fight these guys? And quite frankly, this economic system is rotten to the core. And if we don't consider how to change it so we could cooperate with each other, black and white, rich and poor, not rich and poor, the rich got theirs. We have to develop a cooperative society where we can take care of each other. Of course we can do it, and Barack Obama is welcome to join us. But we all have to go in that direction. This economy is broken. We don't have to fix it. We have to change it. Figure out how to change it.
So thank you for your call, Mike. Gerald Torres, it's going back to the question, what do we do? Talk a bit about, if you could, how what you and Lonnie Guinier wrote about in terms of the concept of enlisting race to kind of resist, to create a political race. What does that mean?
Yeah, one of the things that Lonnie and I wrote about, and your caller did reflect some of this, right, which is that one of the ways that race has been used historically is to divide people who have, in fact, similar interests. Right, and that historically, it was to persuade poor white people that they had more in common with rich white people than they had with poor black people, right? And in fact, what we want to do is to say, well, no. What we have to ask is what institutions in this society aren't working for people, mm-hmm. And we need to understand that race is a political category. It's not an immutable biological category. It's not an immutable category at all. It's a category that's created by a society that people use to cabin other people in ways of thinking. Not that identities have not been created around the communities of color. Of course they have. But it's not essential. It is a way in which society has been divided, and we need to see past that in order to create the political coalitions that are going to be essential to transforming both our economy and our social institutions in order to work for all of us. And that's what political race is really about. It's how do we recognize how our fates are really linked. And it's getting past the idea of what I called earlier kind of interpersonal racism. It's, in some ways our society really is moving in that direction. We have elected an African-American president. There are more interracial marriages. There are more cross-racial friendships. So that in things like that in our culture. And anybody who says there aren't, right, isn't looking at the data. But that doesn't go to the heart of the way the structural racism has affected the institutions in our culture, and that's what we need to look at. And
well, it sadly doesn't necessarily even go to the heart of how race is sort of experienced in people's minds, right?
Exactly.
The reality is that you can be black and walking around and think that black people are inferior, right? Or black people
right.
are more violent, and we. And so we have to be engaged on structural racism, but we also have to be engaged with the media in how they represent and they reinforce, you know, lies about and stereotypes about different groups. I mean, you know, a classic one out there is, for instance, you know, like whenever you see a crackhead on TV, it's a black crackhead.
Right.
Well, the reality is that, you know, whites are 65% of the crack users in this country. We both groups use crack cocaine roughly in accord with their percentage of the population. Blacks are 13-14% of the population, around 14-15% of crack users. But they're 85%. You know, we are 85% of the people who are locked up for using crack.
Right.
And the, you know, in sort of the kind of miner's canary fashion, right, what you see is that it doesn't always stay that way. That once you develop, so you give society permission to engage in mass incarceration as an alternative to, healthcare essentially, right? And as an alternative to rehab and a medical-based approach, then it can jump from group to group, right? So this year, the good news was that black drug incarceration arrests, I believe, were down 40% over the prior year. The other news was that white drug incarceration arrests were up 20%, which, of course, is a net gain. And if you look at right now at the media portrayals of white crystal meth addicts, it's like a film negative of the portrayal of black crack addicts from
right.
20 years ago.
Right.
And, you know, and that's the – I mean, I think that's the thing that white, you know, folks have to understand now is that they're actually more, they're ultimately, you know, either as much or more at risk to the negative effects of racism in our society in a direct way than they ever have been before. That, you know, that once we've, you know, sold the world that we need to quarantine black crack addicts, it's pretty easy to turn around and say, let's quarantine the poor white meth addicts.
Let me return to the phones that our listeners come back to this conversation, try to wind some more of my questions in the middle here at 410-319-8888 with Ben Jealous and Gerald Torres. Pam, in your car, you're on the air.
Thank you, and good evening for taking my call.
Good evening, Pam.
I have two comments. I think that as far as America is concerned, I think we can get to that society that President Obama would like to see, or a lot of people would like to see a post-racial America, but I don't think it would involve people of my generation. I think it's going to be more of the younger generation as each generation grows up and participates with other people of other nationalities. And I think that's one way you're going to get there. But I also feel that I think in a way that black people have kind of gotten, I don't want to use the word apathetic, but we tend to allow things to just pass us by, as what the gentleman was saying. The media does portray us negatively. They never show any of the good things that we do. But I think that we're going to have to start standing up for ourselves and stop depending on the white person for what we need to do for ourselves. And I think we can get better in that way. And that was my comment. I thank you very much.
Pam, thank you so much. Ben Jealous, you want to grab this for something? I mean, there's two issues here. One was the question whether it's a generational issue, whether it has to be the young people to do this and not the old generations, and the other, which is the major discussion as always takes place, whether it's black folks in their own community have to take on this issue themselves.
Sure. You know, to the first, I would say that, to the first issue, that, and as somebody who's on the verge of being middle-aged himself, that it's the middle-aged people who tend to be the problem. You know, we've got a lot of the activists in society tend to historically come from two groups at any moment in American history. They tend to come from those sort of near or below university age, and those near or above retirement age, because the two groups have two things in common. They both perceive themselves as having disposable time because they're students, because they're retired or they're nearly retired, and they're both urgent to change the world. One's about to leave it, the other's about to really inherit control of it.
And it's often those of us, you know, late 30s and our 40s and our 50s who, you know, are just pretty happy with the status quo that can be the biggest problem. But, you know, with regard to the other part about due for, I mean, absolutely. You know, we as black people have, as people of color have greater influence and even control of media than we've ever had in history. Certainly, if you put in all the various types, although that's a fragile equation, and black radio, for instance, right now is very much under feels like it's under siege financially, and even some of the politics surrounding it. We have to be crystal clear about what we're trying to achieve and the ways in which we can be, you know, problematic and actually contribute to these trends. Not unlike, for instance, a black police officer, you know, and the complaints I get oftentimes can adopt racial attitudes that we would typically ascribe to a white officer, you know, historically. But the reality is that it's actually, we also have to recognize that these institutional players have a responsibility to us. They have a responsibility to us because they're on our airwaves, and we are part of the populace that you know, loans them those airwaves. They have responsibility to us because, you know, they're the New York Post, and we buy a lot of their newspapers because we read the sports pages, and we tend to ignore what they write about on the front page. But yet, they have a responsibility because we're making that possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I would never see the responsibility or the opportunity in holding those strong institutions, those mainstream institutions, accountable.
410-319-8888. Charlene, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
This is a wonderful discussion, so excuse my rambling, but I've been holding a sin for 3 months.
Go on, sister. Do it.
You have a tremendous self-control.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm scared now.
Well, you know, I just wanted to say that with looking at the teabaggers over the past couple of months, I've been really anxious and upset about it and wondering why the Obama administration is not speaking out about it and fighting back. And you have truly given me a new perspective. And looking at it, speaking as a middle-aged person, as Mr. Jealous just said.
I'm going to let Ben speak for himself.
I mean, but I had pulled out my books, Time of Terror by James Cameron, and Eyes on the Prize, because I was looking at the angry white mobs before, because this is what the teabaggers reminded me of. And I just feel like we do need to try and work it out with the with other people and not have a revolution or hate people or do other things. And I just really am grateful that you looked at it that way, because I had disowned Obama when he went to Ghana. Then when he came back and he made the statement on Gates, I was like, okay, maybe he's okay. And, you know, it's just a whole bunch of different feelings that I have.
Well, this is actually a place where I've learned something from Reverend Jesse Jackson of late. We've been working together on Rockford, Illinois, and you know, I went out there and I was ready to lead a protest just simply on the issue of law enforcement accountability. And you know, he said, "You know, look around." He said, "You know, this town is ripe for a race riot, and if you go out there, you know, it'll just be black folks, and they'll turn around, and the white cops will march, and soon enough, we'll have that race riot. So let us talk about the most recent wound, but also let us talk about the cancer beneath that, and the, you know, and the cancer beneath that in a place like Rockford, which is, you know, de-industrializing, like sand falling through, you know, an hourglass." You know, is joblessness, is unemployment, is, you know, fear about the economy. So he said, you know, let us also talk about that. And he was right. I mean, that's why we had a march that was 30% white, as opposed to march that was 3% white. And that's what we need at this moment. You know, the teabaggers are really trying, you know, they're out there on the side of the powerful, trying to put out a complete ideology of, you know, basically of greed at the end of the day. You know, we have to challenge that, you know, on both racial terms and on terms of the economy as well.
I'm going to try to get a few more callers in here in the next few minutes before we have to go off the air and leave room for the next show. Gerald Torres, we talked this happened earlier in the show. I mean, I think Vangelis was talking about America is going to be a world that's majority people of color in the next 30 or 40 years, and according to the census. But America, race in America is as the head of our school system here, who's a Latino American, said, is beyond black and white. It has to do with
absolutely
various Latino communities and the Native community and the white community and the black. I mean, it's become a much more complex question than just black and white issues in America.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I mean, one of the issues we don't need to wait for that. I mean, for that statistic nationwide. I think if you look at states like California, you look at states like Texas.
Right.
Yeah. Right. We're already practically there.
Right.
So it's,
California is there.
Yeah, California already is there. Right. So the idea that we're gonna have to wait for that to come is. It's just a kind of a nationwide process, and so one of the things you got to do is you got to look at is how does a state like California to deal with it. But it's not just black and white. And one of the things that Lonnie and I talk about right in our book is that it's important it's important to recognize that one of the ways the script has gotten written in this country, right, is not just in terms of black and white, but what we say is kind of distance from blackness, right? And so that's the old script, right? Because it's not whiteness, right? It's distance from blackness. And what we want to do is we want to say, look, the reason the miner's canary metaphor works is that we want to say that if you look at the way in which the institutions in the United States function for black people, right, and that's why we introduced the idea of political race, because we say black people can actually be any color. Right now, historically, they are the people we all identify as black, because they're the people for whom the institutions of this culture have worked the least well.
Gerald Torres, right? I want to have to interrupt because we're just running out of time here. I want to thank both Gerald Torres and Vangelis for being with us today in this hour. I want to encourage you all to come out to the Enoch Pratt Free Library tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. to meet them in person, hear them talk together in the Open Society Institute Baltimore's year-long series, Do We Still Need to Talk About Race? And you can meet them both personally and also hear their conversation together. And Vangelis and Gerald Torres, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have you both with us for this hour.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
See you all tomorrow night.
All right. See you.
Bye. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And Urbanite Radio Stories and the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Marin Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, presenting his 2009-2010 season featuring Kathleen Battle, Andre Watts, Yitzhak Perlman, and others. Tickets to the Meyerhoff available at 410-783-8000 or at bsomusic.org. And before we leave, reminding you to get your tickets to the first homecoming cruise, a night of fun at the Cotton Club Casino Fun Night Cruise, October 8th, 7 to 10 p.m., sailing from the Inner Harbor, and hear Gene Karn, the great jazz vocalist, sing that evening. Call 410-727-3113 or 1-800-695-BOAT. That's 1-800-695-2628. Or go online at weaa.org to get your tickets. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Justin Levy. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, and Christina Arison. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org and for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.